Hello, this is Ken McLeod. Thousands of people around the world listen to these podcasts every week, just as you are doing now. If you find them helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Your generosity helps us maintain and expand the website for the benefit of yourself and other practitioners worldwide. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered mind, resting, energy, and sentient beings.
So, I'm going to talk a little bit, actually I'm going to talk a lot about resting. And maybe I'm going to talk a lot about it because I find it is one of the most important and also one of the most difficult aspects of practice. That may not be the case for some of you. We all have our strengths and weaknesses. And see, one of the things, it's quite delightful, and this is very rarely discussed in Western Buddhist circles, and that's the issue of talent. You know, in every other area of life, people, it's recognized that some people are good at some things and other people are good at other things. But because of the strong egalitarian impulses in our society, nobody wants to discuss the notion of religious or spiritual talent. And yet, it's all over the place. I mean, the whole Tukul system in Tibet was based on talent, recognition of talent. Behind that lurks a competitive monster, and nobody wants to admit that somebody may be better than them or something like that. It's wonderful. But there are people who find certain aspects of meditation very, very easy, and others who find the same aspects extremely difficult, and vice versa. When I first came to Los Angeles, there was a woman associated with the center that I was sent to administer, who could visualize just like that, just so easily. She could sit down. Everything was, she was generally Z, and the world was Sugavati. That was that. Nothing to that. Didn't help her practice. That's the other thing. And there are people who can just sit down and rest. A lot of people who can see into things, but they can't rest. So resting. Well, there's this way of resting. See, this is the P. Okay. This is stuff that is in our system. Anybody have any of that? So, this is one way of resting. In fact, this is the most common way of resting. You know. You rest, and you rest on top of it. And you think, oh, what a good boy am I. You know, because I'm resting here. And this is very, very common. It's there is no mixing of internal material and attention. It's like oil and water. I've worked with a number of people who this has been their practice, and they've learned to rest, but they have absolutely zero ability to rest in material. They're fine as long as everything is above it, and they can be, and they can actually have quite blissful and steady states, but as soon as they get up from that, they're a jerk, because there hasn't been any mixing of the material. Then there's a second kind of resting. You see, I haven't been meditating today at all. I've been thinking a lot. There's this kind. This is something of an improvement. But only so much. You know, there's a certain acceptance of the material, but there's still very definitely a holding, and that holding away from the material can be quite subtle. It really can be quite subtle. Then there's a third way, which is why I asked Ralph for the tea towel. See? Now you're offering no resistance to the material. So it comes into attention. See, we can see nicely the outline of the material very easily, right? This is the way to rest. And you're going to feel a lot when you do this. Now, it's a little bit strange for some people because as they rest, the mind and body relax. And then they feel all of these subtle little bumps. And there's a good deal of meditation practices, which meditation teaching, which says all of those subtle little bumps are distractions, ignore them. Which takes us back to something like that. I have found quite consistently that when it comes to meditation and spiritual practice, you ignore at your own risk. Inevitably, what you ignore comes back to bite you. And to put it another way, when you don't allow something to come into your experience, there's two things that start to happen. One is it doesn't come into experience because it's being kept out. And then there's the activity or the action of keeping it out, of blocking it, however you do that. Now, as many of you have already described to me, and you know from your own practice before coming here, when you rest deeply, you raise the level of energy in your whole system. Things become clearer, you know, experience becomes more vivid. The body feels lighter, etc. These are all signs of energy being raised. Energy is very egalitarian. It goes everywhere in the system. In particular, when you raise energy in the system, it goes to both what you're keeping out of awareness and also the mechanism for keeping it out of awareness. It goes there as well as it goes everywhere else. The consequence of that is that what is operating out of awareness begins to operate more strongly. And the blocking mechanism operates more strongly. Getting the picture, Nick? Sounding a little too familiar. Over time, you end up torn in two, necessarily. And you see this phenomenon in many, many teachers. It's particularly common in yoga teachers who work with pranayama. And you can tell, because not all of them, many of them have a kind of strain in their face. You ever notice that? Because they're exerting so much control, and they have to keep exerting more and more control to keep that stuff out of attention. And how it shows up in behavior is that people will have these, people who are doing this will have these areas of lives, of their lives, which are somewhat out of control. Maybe obsession with sex, money, power, they're the usual culprits. It can be other stuff, but those are the usual ones. And when they're teaching, they can be extremely good. But in other parts of their lives, there you go. And there is a lack of integration or lack of integration is good enough. because they haven't allowed a particular area of their life into their practice. So when you're resting, rest completely. And if there's a little thing over there, which you think, I don't want to touch that, that's your red flag. And that's about all the red flag you get. After that, it's blocked. You don't get another red flag. So you have to pay attention to that. No, I don't want to deal with that. Next red flag you get, well, things will probably be fairly seriously out of balance. And you're grinning, Ralph.
Yeah, I can relate.
So you can consider that as one point of flogging the dead horse. That's why in the interview, some of you may have noticed I've been poking around a little bit. Nobody's noticed that. I'll have to poke harder. Because there was a person who has become this kind of theme for this retreat, who contacted me because of the podcasts. And a Zen practitioner. And he was describing his practice. And I was feeling in a kind of ornery mood that day, I suppose. So I just said, oh, I guess you don't take the four vows, the Bodhisattva vow in Zen, which is the four vows, very seriously. And he went, what? The four vows in the Zen tradition go approximately, I think I mentioned them the other night. Sentient beings are infinite. I vow to save them all. Emotional reactions are limitless. I vow to release them all. Dharma gates are infinite. I vow to enter them all. Awakening is limitless. I vow to engage it all. Now, these are very profound. And what is often not noticed is that in these four lives there is a progression, which describes the progression that takes place in practice. And this links up, to a certain extent, what I was talking about last night in terms of mythic language. First line, sentient beings are infinite, I vow to save them all. Well, on the one hand, this is the basic expression of compassion. We're going to work for the benefit of sentient beings. But then we have to consider, what is a sentient being? Anybody care to take a crack at that one? Mm-hmm. Dana's just sitting there, not a chance. Not going to touch this. Ken, what is a sentient being?
I believe from the Buddhist perspective, it's any living being that has consciousness, possesses consciousness. Wouldn't include plants.
It depends on your school of Buddhism, mm-hmm. actually. Yeah, that's the usual Buddhist notion. Yeah, I'm not interested in that.
Well, then you pose a profound mystery. There's no, how do you answer such a question? What is life? Mm-hmm.
Well, exactly, but I'm want to hear what you have to say about what a sentient being actually is.
You mean as opposed to a non-sentient being? Like a rock, for example?
No, I'm just... Charles.
In the Platform Sutra, Hui Neng edits the Four Great Vows a little bit.
Yeah.
He says, beings in my own mind are infinite. I vow to save them all.
What's your point? Sounded good, but what's your point?
I've heard you explain this before.
Well, there's no good parroting my words back to me. You need to do this on your own.
Okay. So I can only engage with other sentient beings as they manifest in my experience. So
I'm lost. Start again. You know, too many big words in that sentence. I'm a bear of very little brain. Make it easy for me.
Okay.
She doesn't trust me now.
When you say things like that, I don't trust you either.
You're learning. What is a sentient being, Charles?
Experience.
Right, it's an experience. Good. Everybody got that? Nick?
What?
Have you got that?
Yeah.
It's an experience.
How would then one distinguish a sentient being from any other experience? For example, the experience of stubbing your toe.
Well, I think it was very rude of that rock to hit my toe. It must have willed it. In the burnt offering, you have local demons and regional demons and all of that. That's exactly what they're talking about. They're investing these experiences with a mind. And it's all part of the mystery that you're referring to. So, sentient beings are experiences. And that's what links to the second line. Because what happens when we have a problem with a certain experience called a sentient being? You're game for this one, aren't you, Leslie?
A problem?
Yeah, you have a problem with this experience called a sentient being. What happens in you?
You grasp.
Yeah, there's a reactive emotion comes flying up, right?
Yeah.
So, sentient beings are infinite, I vow to save them all. Reactive emotions are infinite, I vow to release them all. You're moving inwards, you see. Now, what happens when you're completely cornered by a reactive emotion? Have any of you found yourself completely cornered by a reactive emotion?
You can't see.
Yeah. Over this way it's hell. Over this way it's hell. Over this way it's hell. So you turn around, and guess what? It's hell right behind you. Mm-hmm. Now what? What choice do you have at that point?
You don't have any choice.
Yes. This is one of the best things that can happen to you in your Dharma practice. Because when you don't have any choice, what's the only thing you can do?
To surrender.
Yeah. You have to experience exactly what's there. You don't have any choice. There's no way out. What do you find then?
Eventually goes away.
Hmm?
It eventually goes away, but may come again another day.
Read the third line.
Pardon?
The third line.
Oh, you're going to have to say more, Larry.
Well, you're with the experience that you have rather than the one you're looking for.
Yes.
You relate to that.
Yeah, you have to relate to it. What happens when you start relating to it?
And then there's further texture, further experience, some possibility that wasn't there when you're trying to get away.
Late 80s, I had a friend who worked a great deal with people who had AIDS, and this was before the drug cocktails, so most of these people were dying. Some of the people that he tended as they were dying had some fairly interesting things to say. Two that I remember: philosophy is not like ice cubes in the presence of death. I always thought that was pretty good. The other one was, gates look like corners until you go through them. When you get completely cornered, it's actually at that point that you find a gate. And that takes, as Larry pointed out, into the third line. So every one of those reactive emotions is a potential gate. Every sentient being is a potential reactive emotion. Every reactive emotion is a potential gate. I guess you'd be able to get to the fourth one fairly easy. What is every gate? It's a potential awakening. Yeah. So in this formulation of the Bodhisattva vow, the Zen tradition, there's a way it leads us from regarding experience as external to opening up to the possibility of awakening in each moment of experience. Very powerful. The reason I'm making a big deal of it this evening is that there's a word that is common to all four lines. What is it? Well, I suppose it's not really common. There's an idea, a theme that's common to all four lines.
Infinite.
Yeah.
Which is no reference point.
Well, it is no reference point, but it's everything, right? And so right in this is the sense of relating to the totality of our experience, which is exactly the point I was trying to make earlier. So we find this in the traditional teachings. It's expressed often more poetically, not as rationally as I've been talking about it. And because it is expressed poetically, people often miss the point. They either take it literally and think they have to save every sentient being, mm-hmm. which gets a little tricky. Or they just think, oh, that's nice. And they don't really take in the meaning that it's pointing to, which is, this is the totality of our experience, and our practice is working with the totality of our experience.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.